Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Keith Bredge. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the FCC Board. Before I introduce our guest today, please, just a couple of remarks. First, on housekeeping, please, everybody, check your cell phones now. Please turn them off. We do post all of our speeches on YouTube. Some of them have gotten as many as close to 100,000 viewings, and it's a nuisance for everybody if some key remark is blotted out by your ringing phone. So please turn them off, or at least put them on vibrate now. Second of all, I'd like to mention our next speech. We still have room for more signups for it, and that's Carrie Brown, a well-known name for many years in Sinology. He is a professor of Chinese politics at the University of Sydney. He has, like Willie Lam, who spoke here recently, taken a very close look at politics in Xi Jinping's China. And he will be speaking to us at lunch week after next on Wednesday, September 30th, for those of you who are here the week of Mid-Autumn Festival and Chinese National Day. With that, let me introduce our speaker today. Eric Fish is one of the few writers that we've heard from lately who is really looking at what are young people thinking about these days in China. We get so many proposals on the Chinese economy, on Chinese politics to speak, but this is the first in quite a while, and he's not only talks about it, he's written a book that's just come out from the Asia Society, already available on Kindle, should be available here in print soon. This is really pioneering work, is my sense from speaking to him now. I haven't seen anything like it elsewhere. So with that, I'd like all of you to welcome Eric. He was a teacher in Nanjing starting in 2007. He was 7 years in China. He's just been in the past year writing the book. Eric Fish, here he is.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So when I first was looking into doing this book, there are a lot of narratives about young Chinese today, a lot of stereotypes, both domestically within China and abroad. I think the big stereotype domestically within China is that young Chinese today are a very spoiled generation, often called the little emperors, being raised as a largely one-child generation, and can't possibly imagine the hardship that their parents experienced during the Mao era, and especially their grandparents during World War II, very hard times. And then internationally, I saw a narrative a lot that, especially during the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen uprising, that this generation, when compared to that generation, the 80s, has become much too materialistic and money-driven and much too nationalistic to really care about pushing for lofty political or social ideals like was done at Tiananmen. I think that that narrative still has its place. It's not completely worth jettisoning. These are important components to understand young people in China, but I think we're very quickly moving away from that and into a very interesting dynamic with young Chinese. I want to start off with a story of two very different Chinas, and both happened right across the border in Shenzhen. And the first story was in 1993 at a factory called the Jili Doll Factory. And what happened there was the boss at the factory was worried that his employees were going to steal goods that they were producing. So all the doors were bolted shut, the exits were barricaded, so employees were pretty much trapped there except for one exit. And then a fire broke out in 87. All migrant workers were killed in this fire. And after it happened, when they were cleaning up, they found this box of undelivered letters between employees at the factory and other workers in the area. And a scholar sat down and analyzed all these letters, and it really gave a picture of what life was like for these workers then. It was very bleak, very Dickensian. People worried about not getting enough to eat. People were very lonely. At that time, if you got caught on the street without your ID, you could get arbitrarily arrested, giving a pretty crippling fine. So bosses really had their employees under their thumb. And it could be very harsh work. But the workers, the thing that was striking about these letters is what they did not contain. Not a single one talked about complaining to a boss. Not a single one talked about complaining to authorities. So people really just came, put their heads down. Unless they just weren't getting paid at all, would they risk moving on to another factory? They were there to make money and in most cases go back home and kind of start a life with the money that they got. So this is 1993. Fast forward to the very different China in the same place in Shenzhen in 2010. So that year there was this scandal with Foxconn, the Apple manufacturer, after a lot of employees were committing suicide that year. In the end, there was 14, I think, that had killed themselves. So a young intern reporter from Tsinghua University, a 20-year-old intern at Southern Weekend, this very liberal Southern newspaper, he was sent to get a job to cover the factory undercover to kind of see what conditions were like and see what was going on there. And when he arrived, he was actually very surprised. He said, conditions are actually really good. There's a swimming pool, there's a gym, the dormitory is nicer than my Tsinghua University dorm. And that's the impression that he got. And he said there doesn't seem to be a lot that's driving people to suicide. And when you look statistically, given how many employees there were at Foxconn, it wasn't that statistically significant. But the story that he found, he thought, was much more compelling when he talked to the workers and what their ambitions were. And I found this too when I talked to workers there. Most people didn't want to just go back home, start a small business, or start a family. A lot of them wanted to stay there. One guy I talked to wanted to start his own factory. Another guy wanted to learn English and immigrate and teach Chinese to foreigners. So very ambitious. But this reporter, the way he put it, he said, they often dream, but also repeatedly tear apart their dreams, like a miserable painter who keeps tearing up their drafts. If we keep working like this, we may as well keep dreaming for the rest of our lives. He thought that this was compelling because they were very ambitious. They had these great dreams, but every time they thought about it, they thought, well, how am I going to get from this assembly line to this dream? They were seeing factory work as a step on the ladder, and the money that they were making was not an end in and of itself. It was a means to an end, but they were having a hard time finding what social mobility, what was going to take them out of this factory work. And he said, this is going to be a really compelling problem for the government in future years if these people cannot be satisfied if they have these increasingly ambitious dreams that are not being fulfilled. And if you look at what's going on, factory unrest is just growing exponentially in the region. Strikes, labor issues, and there are certainly economic factors behind this, but I don't think that you can discount kind of the shifting mindset among young people and demanding more. And prices are rising, and factories are having to do things to give workers more of a kind of work-life balance, taking workers out on trips on the weekend, setting up skill workshops, having to compete for these workers who increasingly want more out of life. And this is indicative, I think, of a lot of trends happening with this generation. We've heard for a long time that people have been pacified in China because of economic growth. People were very much living subsistence lifestyles for most of Chinese history, and it wasn't until the past 20 to 30 years that this began to change. And the economy started taking off. So people have, I think, been pacified to a large extent by this economic growth. But now you have a generation coming of age that was born after this spike started happening and starting to have had a comfortable upbringing relative to their parents and not so much inclined to take economic growth in and of itself as a pacifying force, starting to want more out of life. And the other big trend is the access to information. So internet access went from next to nothing in 2000 to almost half of China today. And that's even more acute among young people. About 80% of teenagers go online. So they've also been brought up coming of age with very different sources of information. And this is really, I think, changing the way a lot of people think. So when you have these two things, and I would add too that this economic growth, another big impact that this had, was it really brought Big Brother out of people's everyday lives. China used to have these Donwei work units that were kind of the lowest level of the government bureaucracy. And people, if they wanted to get married, if they wanted to travel, they had to get permission from their Donwei. They even monitored women's menstruation cycles in many cases, make sure they weren't getting pregnant when they weren't supposed to. So very invasive. But when the private economy started taking off, these Donwei really collapsed and people got a lot more personal freedom. So Big Brother, whereas he was once leering over your shoulder, he's now kind of gone around the corner. And most young people have not grown up with this kind of instinctive fear of Big Brother, this respect for authority that their parents had. So now when you walk outside in China, I mean, you can see this everywhere. People are becoming very individualistic, exploring all kinds of different personal identities, sexual identities, doing things that would have been very rebellious not too long ago. And in general, just, yeah, again, wanting more out of life. And this is creating a big gap with their parents' generation. So a couple of stats that I think bear this out. 74% of Chinese under 35 say, I have more in common with young people in other countries than with old people in my own country. So starting to feel much a bit alienated from their parents' generation because they grew up under such different circumstances. One woman I talked to in New York a few weeks ago really said something that I thought emphasized this. She said, my parents want me to pursue materialism, but I want to pursue meaning. And she was an aspiring writer, and she was in New York studying abroad kind of to get away from her parents and the pressure that they put on her to get married and get a stable job. She wasn't interested in financial stability. She wanted to make something meaningful herself. Another stat, 62% of China's religious believers are aged 16 to 49. So quite contrary to the trend in most developed countries of the elderly population being religious. So again, I think this speaks to the sense of fulfillment and meaning that young people are starting to crave ahead of just material concerns. 63% say a lot of people my age are seeking jobs that give back to society, wanting to do something meaningful, impactful. Then I think the most significant, 78% say my generation isn't afraid to take up a cause and do it ourselves if higher powers fail to act quickly and adequately. And you can see this in all different aspects of Chinese society. These environmental protests that have taken off the last few years. People have taken to the streets by the tens of thousands to protest over environmental issues. Social activists. One of the most notable example, I think, were these feminists, five of whom got arrested a few months ago for pushing what should not be incredibly controversial causes, but still willing to put their neck on the line. Because feminism is not a direct, when you go out on the street like this as a young Chinese woman, the hope of changing the culture and the legal atmosphere in favor of feminism, that's not gonna have a whole lot of impact on your immediate day-to-day life. You can only suffer for it, which they did, and they suffered quite badly, but still willing to stick their neck out, less afraid and more willing to push for kind of loftier ideals. And I thought this was one of the more significant. Southern Weekend in 2013, when this liberal Southern newspaper had a tiff with the local censor, and word leaked out. Young people, especially across the country, were uploading pictures of themselves saying, let's go Southern Weekend, supporting them. And then even more significantly, the people that showed up to protest in person outside the paper's office. I think this is a very telling photo. At the protest, the police were walking around taking pictures, trying to kind of intimidate the protesters. And you can see from her, she was not intimidated. So this sort of speaks to the fearlessness in a lot of young people. And then quickly, two other activists that I thought were very significant. This woman was a 21-year-old design student who was supporting this imprisoned human rights lawyer, started this campaign holding pictures of herself. She got a lot of other people to do it. And then this guy, a student studying in the US a few months ago, he wrote this open letter blasting the government, telling them to reevaluate the verdict on Tiananmen and basically calling the government fascist. And he got a lot of people to sign this open letter, hundreds of people, most of them in mainland China. And I talked to both of these people and I said, like, how do your peers see you? Like, are you seen as weird? Do people stay away from you? And they said, a few years ago, it would have been like that. Like, we would have been pariahs. People would think we're dangerous to associate with. But more and more, people not only accept what we're doing, but also support it. And they were finding friends just in their immediate circle. They weren't having to go online to find somebody across the country. Just people that were at their school, very close to them, were starting to think, yeah, it's okay to be rebellious. So this is one side of the equation. Young people wanting more and be more willing to speak out for it. The other side of the equation is the reality in China that's setting in. A lot of issues are emerging in China right now that are very difficult for young people. Every year, a lot more college graduates and a lot fewer jobs for them. The number of college graduates has been growing by about 250,000 every year. And at the same time, the number of jobs available for them is shrinking. So you have a lot of people who are expecting good white-collar work, not getting it. Income inequality, so Gini coefficient, China is the red line. US is the blue line. Wealth inequality is just going off the charts. And a lot of young people I talk to really feel this in the employment market. According to one survey, 80% think that young people who achieve career success only do so because of their family connections. Only 10% thought that hard work, creativity, basic personal ability beat having a well-connected father. And there is a sense that I felt from talking to a lot of young people that they really missed the boat. If you were capable at the beginning of reforms, there were so many industries that were there to be tapped. But the older generation has kind of taken those over, and now all this wealth and power that's amassed is accumulating among an increasingly small circle of elites. So if you're not born into one of those circles, there's not much social mobility. Urban-rural gap. So both have grown exponentially incomes, but urban has grown much faster than rural. So rural people are at a bigger disadvantage. And now a lot of rural migrants are coming to the cities and seeing the opportunities that their urban peers have that they are being denied. It's even worse if you're a woman. The income gap between men and women has gotten wider and wider over the last 20 years. And this is especially true for rural women, now making 56% on average what their male counterparts are making. Aging population is getting out of control because of the one-child policy largely. You have the 4-2-1 problem in a lot of families. Four grandparents, two parents, one child with the burden of taking care of them, putting immense pressure on a lot of young people. And then what I think is going to be the biggest wild card in China is this gender imbalance. The number of excess men of marriage age is growing by about 1 million every year. And this is, experts expect very little good to come from this. If you look at the statistics, unmarried men are 3 times more likely to kill than married men. And if you look at history, even in China, there's been some great upheaval in history when you've had these gender imbalances. The 19th century had this problem. You had all sorts of rebellious movements where it's kind of easy to whip up these single men that had nothing else to do. So this could, I think, and this is putting a lot of pressure on people, especially like in the marriage market, being pressured to accumulate wealth, buy a house. So a lot of very compelling issues affecting this generation. And at the same time, much more demand out of life and much more willingness to speak up for it. So I don't know where this is going. I'm afraid I'm gonna have to leave it to you to conclude. But I think this is gonna be a very interesting dynamic that plays out in the future. And I will say one more thing about this narrative I mentioned earlier, that Chinese youth have become too nationalistic to push back against authorities. And you did have this patriotic education that was launched in 1991 that's very much emphasized the century of humiliation and refocusing attention towards foreign powers. And I think it's worth noting that, well, I'm going to mention briefly these guys that I wrote about. The first one is Tsai Yang. So this guy became famous during the 2012 anti-Japan protests. And what happened, he was at a protest in Xi'an, and somebody was driving through in a Toyota, and he pulled him out, beat him on the head with a bike lock, left the guy paralyzed. And he was on this most wanted list in the country, along with a lot of other guys who'd gotten violent at these protests. Then reporters started looking back into his background, and they found he was this really marginalized, kind of alienated migrant worker. He'd failed the college entrance exam. He was doing painting in new buildings, doing migrant work. He often just escaped into video games. And they looked back at his microblog, and he said, "Please, God, grant me a wife," and miserable post-90s generation. And this kind of spoke to a lot of these people. And there were a lot of stories that came out like this in the media of some of these guys who'd gotten really violent. And this goes back to the gender imbalance question. And how throughout history there's been a lot of guys like this kind of at the bottom of society that lashed out. And they talked to his friends afterwards and they found, yeah, when this protest against Japan started, it kind of put a spark in him. It made him feel significant, gave him something to feel important to do. And I mean, this is what you saw in 19th century China, a lot of these guys that were whipped up. So this is one aspect of nationalism. The other aspect, this guy I talked to, Rao Jin, I think a lot of reporters might have heard of what he did. He was this Tsinghua University student who, in 2008, there were riots in Tibet, and he was very dissatisfied with how some foreign media were covering the riots. So he started this website called Anti-CNN to highlight the biased reports of Western media. And I talked to him, and he kind of laughed, and he said, "The first thing that foreign reporters always ask me is, are you being paid by the government?" And he laughed because he said, "That's impossible. I love to criticize the government also." And in fact, he went on to say some very critical things of the Chinese government. So I mention these guys because I think too often people conflate nationalism with support for the government. But if I were the Chinese government, I mean, you have these two people who fall under the nationalist umbrella at very opposite spectrums. But if I were the government, I would not take great comfort in either one of these people. Because like I mentioned, people like Tsai Yang, that sort of angst can be easily directed towards other causes. He was angry at Japan. He was kind of releasing his frustrations that day. But that could be a lot of different issues that could come up. And again, going back to 19th century China, that often manifested in itself ways rebellious of the government. And then on the higher end of the socioeconomic food chain, again, in history in China, you've had so many nationalistic movements that started out against foreign countries that sort of then evolved towards criticizing domestic leaders. This is the May 4th movement. There was a movement against Japan in 1935 that twisted towards the government. Then in the late 1980s, there were some nationalistic movements against Japan, and there were some anti-African protests in Nanjing where people started putting almost on the same placards sometimes, like fight the foreign devils, oppose corrupt Chinese officials. And then this spiraled into more focused on Chinese leaders in the 86-87 protest and ultimately Tiananmen. So I would not take great comfort in guys like this, in nationalism, if I were the government. It can be a useful tool on one hand, but it can quite easily backfire. So again, I don't want to make any arch conclusion here, but I think that the idea that Chinese are pacified politically and that they won't be a voice for social political change in China, I think that's quite a bit overblown, and I think we're getting further and further away from that narrative as being useful. So again, I'll have to leave it to you to leave your own conclusions, but I think Chinese youth and the way that they're changing is going to be a very interesting dynamic in China in the coming years. So I'll go ahead and wrap it up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, for that fascinating discussion. Why don't I throw open the floor? Please identify yourselves, and maybe David, if you'd like to go first.
Thanks, David Schlesinger. First of all, it's a terrific book, very well written. I really enjoyed it. It's for so long, we've so easily just talked in shorthand about the 80s generation and the 90s generation to represent youth. But of course, if you just do the math, the inexorable march of history means that these guys are now solid adults and creeping into middle age, even in some cases with their own children. How do you think they'll be as middle-aged rebels? And what kind of parents will they make as they now look at the next generation coming up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too. And I think, yeah, your parents do have a big influence on you. And like I said, this narrative of youth that are pacified materially and like with nationalism, that's not worth jettisoning yet. I think that is still a big part. But you do have a lot of young people whose parents, like that grew up in the 80s, kind of removed from that, and they're not so harsh on them about these issues. So I think, you know, when they grow up, this generation still largely has parents who lived through a lot of very harsh stuff and want stability, want security for their kids above all else. So when they see them doing activism or doing things that don't match the formula of studying hard, graduating, getting a good stable job, getting married, having a kid, if they break that status quo, they're not very happy with it. So there's this very big intergenerational conflict. When this generation comes of age and starts raising their children, I think it's going to be very interesting because, I mean, the logical thing would seem that it goes even further when they grew up, I mean, much more liberal-minded and active than their parents were, and now they're raising children. I don't know, but I got to think it's going to keep going in that direction unless something big happens again. I talk about this trend of people being more outspoken, willing to push for things, more idealistic. But of course, that's what seemed to be happening in the 80s. And of course, that came to a very abrupt halt on June 4th, 1989. So, I mean, things that seem to be good, positive trends or whatever trend you think is unfolding, that can often change very quickly, especially in China. So I would be very, very hesitant to make any kind of prediction about what the next generation is going to be like.
Back here, please, and then next.
Hi, my name is Mitya Nguyen. I found it really interesting, so thank you very much. I was particularly struck by your slide on finding meaning and those four questions you had up, and then perhaps also this last slide, because I thought there's a lot of similarities to younger generations outside China, and perhaps with the exception of the data on the age group that goes for religion, I think you could say similar things about younger generations around the world and certainly in the West. So I guess my question is, to what extent is what you're seeing younger generations in China becoming similar to younger generations around the world, perhaps on as a result of more information availability, or to what extent do you think that's not appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, coming from the US, I definitely did recognize a lot of similarities. I mean, young Americans also get like these labels of being, you know, spoiled and not appreciative of hard work. And I mean, you can find all sorts of anecdotes as like why this is true, and survey data suggesting this is true becoming more demanding. So I think in both cases, you can look both ways. I mentioned like with the factory workers, young people becoming much more ambitious, but much less willing to do harsh factory work, which is something they get chastised a lot for. But yeah, at the same time, being very ambitious, wanting more fulfillment. I mean, in both countries, you see volunteerism rising, people wanting to not just make their life better, wanting to change the world. And in a lot of cases, yeah, these expectations are very lofty and maybe unreasonable. You see this with college graduates in America expecting much better work than they can end up having. One really interesting thing I saw too, I mean, Chinese youth now with all these kind of scary economic things happening, this of course disproportionately affects people just entering the workforce. And this was really what was happening with American millennials after the financial crisis. So the immediate atmosphere for work is very daunting. But in both cases, when you look at the surveys, both groups, the US and Chinese young people, are very optimistic about the future. I mean, I forgot what the exact stat was, but I think in China, it's over 80% are optimistic about the economic future of China. And I think this gets to a sort of individual level. And being confident in people's own abilities. As Americans have the same thing, things are bad for me now, but I know I'm capable. Eventually somebody will recognize my talents and things will be okay at last. And speaking to young Chinese, I hear a lot of this too. So these are just some interesting similarities. Again, I don't know where that's leading, but interesting thing to keep your eye on.
Over here, please.
Hi, Shalini Mitani from the Zubin Foundation. I have two very quick questions. First one is about religion. So I was really interested in that high percentage of youth who are religious, and I was interested in what religion and how are they getting introduced to religion, who's introducing them to religion, if you could answer that. And the second one is, given the more open nature of the youth today, what do you see for the LGBT population, specifically the lesbian and gays in China? Thank you.
Yeah, so I did a full chapter exploring young Christians, so I didn't get too much into the other religions. But like as far as what's making them convert, I mean, I don't even get the impression that which religion is necessarily important. I think a lot of people are looking for something to believe in. And there was one guy I talked to, it was really interesting. He had become a Christian after watching the movie Forrest Gump. And he, if you haven't seen it, there's a scene in the movie where he's on the Dick Cavett Show with John Lennon, and he's talking about going to China to play ping pong. He said, oh, they don't have religion there. John Lennon's like, oh, it's hard to imagine. And this young college student that I talked to, he had seen that, and he thought, huh, that's kind of weird that foreigners would think not being religious is weird. So he went to a little house church near campus, and after the first time, like he said, oh, we held hands, sang songs, it was like a family, like I was sold. And that just kind of spoke to how like any little thing can kind of hit the first domino over. And I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why people convert. There is this idea that some scholars have explored of the post-communist personality, in that the communist economic system collapsed, and with it went the communist social order, like the lei feng, and kind of be altruistic for the good of the masses, but then people start getting filthy rich, so like what's right, what's wrong. But religion kind of gives a steady, clear set of rules. And a lot of people I talked to said they had like a generation gap with their parents, like I mentioned, and they go to church and they just get this unconditional love. And I think that's more appealing to a lot of people than whatever scripture that they're studying. and just kind of the social atmosphere that they have with other people, and to get this kind of love and understanding that they don't get at home. So I hear this about Buddhism. I haven't looked into Buddhism as well, but I think I've heard that's growing very quickly too. I don't know which, but I mean, every religion in China is still growing quite rapidly, and that's especially true for young people. Then your second question, sorry, what was the second?
The openness of the LGBT population,
right.
The youth.
Yeah, if you, again, I can't think of the stats off the top of my head, but acceptance for that is becoming quite high among young people. I think it's over half now of, forgot the cutoff, but of people under a certain age is accepting of that. So I think, yeah, they're making pretty good gains. And again, now there's a big disconnect with older generations that are much more traditional, but as far as what they're gaining in terms of legislation, they still have a long ways to go. The last big victory was having homosexuality taken off of the mental disorder list, and that was 2001. They haven't had any huge gains since then. A lot of people want an anti-discrimination law, which they don't have yet. Gay marriage, that probably won't happen for a long time, but I think this is one of many issues where young people are becoming much more liberal, accepting than older generations, and quite quickly. Over here, please.
Thanks. I'm Jana Leno from the Australian Consulate. I have two questions. They're sort of related. It's about the attitude of young people towards the authorities and towards the government. You said that they have much less respect and fear of the government and the authorities than perhaps their parents. So I'm wondering, do you get the sense that young people are not intimidated by, for example, roundups of human rights lawyers? I saw that young woman in the photo that you presented was supporting Puigdemont. Are they not intimidated? And I guess a sort of related question is, what is their general attitude towards the government? I mean, are they generally accepting that the Communist Party should always be there? Are they accepting of the government's legitimacy, if you like?
So I think the really interesting thing with young Chinese today is how divergent opinions are on issues like that. I mean, you can ask 10 people some question on politics and get 10 answers. I mean, there's people all the way from like ardent supporters of the Communist Party to like very, like some of those people, they're very quite critical. I've done no systematic survey on this, but just in the young people I've talked to, I've got an impression that's probably the prevailing opinion is kind of a twist on the old Winston Churchill quote, only with the Communist Party, and that it's the worst possible system except for any other possible system that could possibly replace it. And that, yeah, they recognize that there's a lot wrong with it and it's far from an ideal system, but they've delivered so far, so why rock the boat? They're probably better than anything that could replace it. So I don't see much excitement about overthrowing the system. It's more about very tangible, like freedom of press, like at the Southern Weekend protest, corruption, much more kind of tangible, immediate things. As far as like having less respect for authority, I think like when you see people get rounded up, that certainly has an effect on some people. But I mean, look what happened when the feminists were arrested. People were uploading pictures of themselves again, protesting this. People were speaking out online. You had this one group of women that were going around taking pictures of themselves with masks on of the five that had been detained. So it really prompted a lot more outcry than there even was initially. So yes, those roundups do scare people. But I think, again, yeah, it's creating more empathy, I think, than fear. And there used to be a certain nuance to how, like under Hu Jintao, the government approached dissent. They really only used to take out the really hardcore people that challenged their very legitimacy, like your Liu Xiaobo's. And not a lot of Chinese got too excited about that in general, if they heard about it, which most people didn't. The same case with these feminists. But I mean, like the people they're targeting now, these women were handing out stickers against sexual harassment, or they were planning to. They didn't even do it. And they just, I mean, a lot more people can empathize with that. A lot more people, it hits a lot closer to home. So I really wonder what this is doing in the long run and how many more activists they're creating and clamping down on people like this. And also, these women were pretty focused on feminist issues, and they have always been quite careful not to quite careful to illustrate that they are not against the government. They just want feminist rights. But in doing this, they made a lot of people take a much broader interest in politics. So I think this clampdown is scaring a lot of people in the short term. But in the long run, I think they could be making a lot more enemies for themselves.
OK, up here, please.
My name is Cecilia. I'm from Master of Journalism at HKU. I just have a question for you. As you just mentioned that there was a large amount of young Chinese students who maybe who choose to go abroad to study there and maybe to work after their graduation. So do you see any differences between students who have been abroad and young Chinese people who stay in China?
That's kind of my next big project. Now that I'm living in New York, I'm starting to try to interview a lot of Chinese overseas students to get an impression. I haven't looked into this very deeply yet, but there seems to be two kind of schools of thoughts, and probably both have validity. And one is that when you're in kind of an open Western democracy, you become much more liberal and much more critical of your own country. But the other side, there's actually been studies on this even, that a lot of Chinese become more intensely Chinese, much more patriotic, because they're often forced to defend their country's position with people in the country that they're in who might not have a very nuanced view of it, who might take a very critical approach with them. I would be very hesitant to generalize. And I think, young Chinese who want to learn more about what's going on past what the censorship is allowing on China's internet, they can find out. There are ways of getting this information. So I don't know that there's a huge, huge difference. I will say it has been very interesting, though, talking to young people in New York recently from China. And some of them, like this woman I mentioned earlier who wanted to be a writer, and the last half of that quote that I didn't say, she said, My parents want me to pursue materialism. I want to pursue meaning. And she said, but it's getting very hard to do that in China. And I've met a couple of documentary filmmakers who are kind of in the same boat that, there's a lot we want to do, but it's so hard to do some of these kind of things that push. And like the same is true for people that are like interested in being in NGOs. That atmosphere is becoming much worse. So unfortunately, I think a lot of potential change makers in China are getting kind of pushed out so that they can pursue these loftier ambitions of theirs. So yeah, that's another kind of thing pulling against a lot of what I was talking about, against young people wanting to push for change. So yeah, I don't know. It'll be another thing to keep an eye on.
Over here, Edith, please.
Edith Terry. I'm definitely planning to buy your book. my question is about national education, which has been in place in China for nearly 25 years. Did you try to test attitudes against the benchmarks of the national education program, particularly attitudes towards foreign countries like U.S. and Japan, and sort of acceptance of the notion of 150 years of national humiliation?
Yeah, there's actually a really good survey that came out a few months ago by a scholar named Andrew Chubb at the University of Western Australia, like testing attitudes on some of these issues and on like some of these territorial conflicts. And one survey question that really I thought was interesting: post-90s Chinese, they were less likely to favor going to war with Japan or with the country in the South China Sea over these territorial issues. Older people were more willing to go to war. But young people were more likely to frame these issues as a continuation of the century of humiliation. So it really seems to suggest that this education has had an influence, has had a big impact in shaping the way young Chinese see the world. So they're, like, even in the South China Sea, none of those countries were involved in the century of humiliation from mid-1800s, starting with the Opium War to World War II with Japan. But still, they framed it as part of that. So that kind of seems to suggest that it has had an influence. But at the same time, much more individualistic and less inclined to go to war over these things. I think, more inclined to see sort of a nuanced view of it. And like the national education, I did talk to a lot of people. This was one big story I did before I ever wrote the book, and how this patriotic education is received. And I think, you know, a lot of the very nationalist kind of anti-foreign stuff over territorial issues regarding Tibet, I think a lot of that does sink in with a lot of people. The stuff about like the Communist Party being the great hope of China, I think people tend to be more cynical of stuff like that. And my impression was these political courses that students have to sit through in college, like most people, yeah, are quite bored with them. And several students told me, yeah, the teacher doesn't even try to convince you that this subject matter is true. They just teach you how to pass the test. And one student said they recalled a teacher saying, on a test question, if Lenin said it, it must be the right answer. So just, yeah, kind of they go through the material because they have to, but I don't think a lot of people are too inspired by it. I don't know if that answers your question. I think a lot of people are still quite cynical of a lot of the, and this is a thing too I've heard a lot from other reporters as well as what I saw, is that this very patriotic education that people know is quite biased towards the government's point of view really prompts people to look on their own if they're curious about what's really going on. It's like in America, we don't think that we're being brainwashed. We assume that we're learning in school most of the time is more or less true, so it doesn't really prompt a lot of people to dig deeper. But I've heard from a lot of Chinese that they are curious about what's really happening, so they do get VPNs. They do try to search out a little more because they know they're being told on TV in schools isn't necessarily true.
Okay. We are at 2 o'clock, which is normally our cutoff. Why don't we just take 2 minutes, if you can each ask your two questions, and maybe you can answer both of them at the same time as one question. If you give first to me.
Yes, hi, I'm Houghton Lee, member. What is the general view of America among the youngsters in China?
Hi, I'm Phoebe Smith from the Australian Consulate. You talked about the tension between aspirations and reality, and also how some of the government action against social activists has prompted more activism, particularly in light of social media. What does that mean for the future? Where is all the energy going to go from the young people? Do you think the government has got any approach, or do you think it will pan out in violent protests or more political protests? It's quite a big question to finish on, maybe.
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer, but I really have no idea. I think this is something the government's definitely cognizant of. The last few years of Hu Jintao, you did have all these protests building up, environmental protests especially, and this wild discourse on social media, on all sorts of things, on like corrupt officials, on like the Wenzhou train crash, and that's really been tamped down. I think Xi Jinping is really been aware of this stuff and keen to rein it in. So I think that has been their approach, and so far it seems to be working. But like I talked about, I think they are creating more activists in the long run. But where this leads, I mean, this is like I was saying, I mean, in the 80s you saw a lot of idealistic, less fearful youth, and that ended on June 4th, 1989, and then things went in a very conservative direction for the next, I mean, up till today. So I don't know. I don't know where it goes. If one day it'll get out of hand, one day it'll become violent. I don't know is my answer, my short answer, unfortunately. To your question about seeing America, again, ask 10 people, you get 10 views. There are people who see America as heaven, this shining city on the hill. You have some people that see it as the great hegemonic devil. But I think, again, the plurality of people see a sort of nuance. I think a lot of young people hate American incursions into foreign countries, hate bossing around countries telling them what to do. But I mean, American pop culture is so popular. American celebrity is very popular. So I don't see many young people just rejecting it out of hand and being unambiguously critical. I think, yeah, it depends on what you're talking about. And I mean, as an American, I've had outright hostility from young Chinese in China. The 7 years I was there, maybe twice that happened. So everybody other than that was mostly quite nice and quite intrigued about it. So yeah, I think that's the prevailing opinion.
Thank you all for coming. We always like to give our guests something to remember the club by. So thank you, Eric, and we hope to see many more of you on in 2 weeks. Carrie Brown, thank you. And I think you said you'd be willing to stay on a little after if people want to come up and ask any further questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you.